You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, astronomers had never observed a black hole and a neutron star colliding until UW-Milwaukee scientists helped make the discovery this year. We'll talk to one of the researchers about what they found and what it can teach us. Now, private companies and their owners are making the move into space. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos plans to make a trip into space next week on a ship made by his company Blue Origin, but fellow billionaire Richard Branson beat him there over the weekend. The owner of Virgin Galactic, Branson flew into space for several minutes and came down safely. While in the weightless zone, he had a message for a younger generation.
To all you kids down there, I was once a child with a dream, looking up to the stars. Now I'm an adult in a spaceship with lots of other wonderful adults looking down to our beautiful, beautiful Earth. To the next generation of dreamers, if we can do this, just imagine what you can do.
Both Branson and Bezos may offer the chance for people to visit space in the future. That could cost up to $250,000 per ticket. Meanwhile, Elon Musk's SpaceX has already sent astronauts to space and back. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these private companies getting into space flight and space tourism? Should near and outer space be something that's shared and regulated by government agencies? Are you excited to see what private businesses can do? If you had the chance to go into space yourself, $250,000 to spare, would you make the flight? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marina Corin is a staff writer covering space exploration for The Atlantic. Marina, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, Branson up and down. Bezos scheduled to go next. Before we dig into the specifics, I mean, does this feel like this is a moment of change for how we think about going up out of Earth's atmosphere?
It really, really does. This is definitely a turning point in American spaceflight. Excuse the pun, but space tourism is really taking off this year. You have Bezos flying next week. Branson is, I'm sure, still kind of basking in the glow of having flown successfully to the edge of space and back. This is the world we're living in now. You know, you have spaceflight companies run by eccentric space billionaires, some of whom can decide to actually ride their systems right into space.
And let's talk about, maybe this is nitpicky, I don't know, but it seems like it's an argument in the astronaut and space community. What does it mean to be in space? How high would I have to go to be considered to be in space or in orbit?
This is a great question, and it's actually a surprisingly fraught question. you would think that we would all, as inhabitants of the planet Earth, be in agreement about where Earth ends and space begins. But people have different opinions. Virgin Galactic and Richard Branson, that camp, which actually includes NASA and U.S. military agencies, they say that space begins 50 miles up above the Earth's surface. Now, some international agencies and other groups, including Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos, they think that it starts 62 miles up. So, you know, if you ask Jeff Bezos today, did Richard Branson beat you to space? He would probably say no. So what Branson and Bezos are doing is they want paying customers to take these suborbital trips, which is very different from what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX. He is actually going to put people into orbit to loop around the Earth. And, you know, he's done that already with NASA astronauts and taken them to the International Space Station. That's a completely different experience. I think if you're orbiting the Earth, I think everyone would agree in that case that you're definitely in space.
Now, you know, thinking back to the era of Right Stuff, these heroic astronauts taking their chances, going to space, new bold new frontiers and things like that. And now it's rich dudes showing off their technology. I don't know. Is this a letdown for how we're getting into space?
I would say that it's different. Like you said, the Right Stuff was like this set of secret sauce qualities that NASA astronauts had that made them almost these mythical figures. You know, they had something to them that made them worthy of not only working for NASA, but of also representing, you know, in the case of the Apollo moon missions, of representing humankind in a way. So the world is definitely at a point where there's a new vision of astronauts and who can become an astronaut and who decides. So, you know, it is going to be a lot of rich people for the foreseeable future, because, you know, Virgin Galactic ticket is very expensive, Blue Origin ticket, very expensive. But at the same time, you know, Jeff Bezos on his flight next week, he decided to bring with him an aviation legend, Wally Funk, and she's wanted to be an astronaut since the 1960s. She's 82 years old today, so this is a lifelong dream of hers. So, you know, the definition is changing. On the one hand, you do have the very wealthy being able to take these joyrides, but at the same time, you have the very wealthy inviting people, real people, to come along with them. It's definitely an interesting time.
Talking to Marina Corin from The Atlantic, where she covers space exploration, looking at the rich guy race to space. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have hopes that, yeah, maybe it's costly now, but this is going to pave the way for more common space exploration near and then maybe far? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's look at some of the technology here, Marina. This isn't what we might think of, the Richard Branson Virgin Galactic thing here. This isn't getting into space the way we might think of, with this big rocket blasting off from the ground. How did it launch?
Right. So Virgin Galactic does things a little differently. It's not the traditional picture that I think many people have of a rocket standing vertically on a launch pad, you know, along a coast with the ocean in the background and then just rising into the sky. What Virgin Galactic does, they actually have a giant carrier plane that carries a separate space plane to high up into the sky to about 50,000 feet. And at that point, when the time comes, this carrier plane basically drops the space plane, which sounds a little wild because that space plane a couple of days ago was carrying Richard Branson and a few Virgin Galactic employees and a couple of pilots. And so once that space plane is released, it ignites its own engines and then completes the rest of the journey up to just beyond the edge of space, and hurtles itself up there. Experience a couple of glorious minutes of weightlessness. And then this space plane glides back down to Earth and lands on a runway, which might be a bit, that part is a little bit familiar, I think, from people who remember the shuttle and how that landed. But it's a different system to the way, it's different from what Blue Origin and SpaceX are doing, which is a bit more like just shoot the rocket from the ground into space.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, but I personally feel that this whole thing is absurd beyond ridiculous. That we have billionaires flying into low Earth orbit just for bragging rights and just for one-upsmanship, when we actually have real problems facing the entire planet, including our whole the ecosystem pretty much across the planet, which is life for all of us. This is absolutely, absolutely ridiculous. If they want to experience a few minutes or a few seconds of weightlessness, go swim in a pool.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Marcus, not alone in that thought, I think, Marina, as I look around the internet, people saying there's a lot of money and effort for what, when we got bigger problems we could be spending our money on. How have these rich people going into space kind of tried to sell this idea to the rest of the world?
Right. Yeah, this is definitely a common criticism. And there was actually an online petition floating around, a lot of signatures, people saying that Jeff Bezos shouldn't come back from space. I mean, Marcus is definitely not alone in this, as you said. And I think it's I don't think the question is space travel or tackling Earth's problems. Like, I don't think it's an either or proposition, but I can completely understand why, you know, giving the timing, this is a bad look. And what Bezos and Branson have done is, they're very much aware of this argument, and they tried to tell people, you know, we want to make it cheaper to do this kind of space travel, and we want, you know, regular people to have this experience someday. Bezos and Branson are also philanthropists. Blue Origin just today donated a bunch of money to many, many scientific institutions and, organizations that support STEM careers. But at the same time, you know, they are their own people. They have their own fortunes. And I feel like we can't exactly depend on the billionaires to save the planet. You know, like, there are many other ways to look at that. But I completely understand the sentiment of, you know, why now? Why are they doing this now?
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Marina Corin right now from The Atlantic, where she covers space exploration. We're looking at trips by billionaires into space and what it means for private companies to get into the space game. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a good thing? Are you glad to see this happen? Do you hope this paves the way for more and more affordable space travel or missions to, I don't know, Mars or back to the moon? Do you like seeing private business involved, or should it be run by public agencies like NASA? And if you had the cash to go on a space tourism flight, would you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Marina Corin of The Atlantic about private companies investing in space flights, with CEOs like Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson making trips into space, depending on how you define that, themselves. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you annoyed by these flights? Are you excited at the prospect for more humans in orbit and beyond? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls. Deborah is with us in Winona. Deborah, hi.
Hi. I am wondering if your guest has any idea of how many tons of greenhouse gases these two space flights and making space a tourist destination is going to spew into the atmosphere. And I totally agree with the previous caller, Mark.
Deborah, thanks a lot for the call. Marina, do we know just a couple of flights here, but how much climate change emissions they might be putting out?
And this is a really good question. I wish I had the numbers. I'm not a climate reporter, but I think one way to think about this is, this is the second Virgin Galactic flight of the year. There might be two more by the end of this year. So let's say four flights this year. Compare that to how many airplane flights are happening this year. I mean, this is a tiny, tiny fraction. I think this becomes an important question once this industry, if this industry of space tourism scales up. And I think that it's still a long way away from that. You know, it's still dangerous. Richard Branson's flight on Sunday was actually still a test flight. You know, they have two more flights that they want to do before they put actual paying customers on board. So I think this will be an important question as more and more flights take place every year. I don't think we're at that point yet. And then it raises all kinds of interesting questions about, you know, if these space billionaires are trying to make space tourism like air travel, they're going to have to be they're going to have to subject themselves to a lot more regulation. So that could also play into, emissions coming out of these flights in the future.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Elizabeth in Verona, who asked, I understand that Virgin Galactic's mission did get taxpayer support, maybe in the millions. Elizabeth says, do we know more about that? So, Marina, does some government money still go into these projects that private companies are doing?
Yes, definitely. And I think it's a common misconception that, you know, it's these private companies versus NASA, that SpaceX is leapfrogging NASA. But the truth is that SpaceX wouldn't be where it is today without NASA and without taxpayer funding. So last year, when SpaceX put two astronauts into space for the very first time, they did that on NASA's behalf, but they also did it because NASA gave them a ton of money to develop this system. So, you know, these private companies benefit from government funding, and they will continue to in the future. For example, right now, you know, NASA wants to return Americans to the surface of the moon for the first time since 1972. And when they do that, they're going to go with a private company. Blue Origin and SpaceX have both pitched themselves to NASA, for landing technology to the moon. And it was a bit of a controversy earlier this year because NASA picked SpaceX and Blue Origin was not happy and decided to contest that decision. But, you know, these companies are very much in the game, and NASA, in a sense, needs them. And so it supports them and holds them up.
We are talking about near-Earth space flight by private companies and the people who own them. Marina Koren is with us from the Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Again, 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marina, are these companies, assuming they start selling these tickets, like, are they knocking on the door of actually making profits off of space tourism, or is that like something that's years away?
I think it will be profitable quickly. I mean, just when you look at the prices of these flights, a Virgin Galactic ticket right now costs $250,000. A SpaceX ticket costs $55 million. I mean, that's a bit more like all-inclusive. There are a couple of businessmen who are flying to the ISS later this year, $55 million each. That's a lot of money.
Wow. Let's go back to our callers now. Joe is with us in Star Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm fascinated by how people behave because of myths that are deeply embedded in the mind. And many of these people that are now making these trips, you know, and doing all this grew up in the age of Star Wars movies and so forth. And another movies that were very common then were alien movies, Close Encounter. Right now, we're having two stories that are kind of coming out about space. And one is coming out of the Pentagon and coming out of fighter pilots that can land on aircraft carriers, which is no easy feat. It's 60 Minutes, which I've always considered credible, about these things that fly with a technology far beyond anything we have. I'm wondering what the buzz is among the people working for Bezos and for, you know, these different folks about whether they think this is real and that there are any other kind of technology or visitations from other sources. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Joe, thanks for the call. Joe, referring to the release by the Pentagon of some videos and statements from fighter pilots of unidentified flying objects, which doesn't, again, I've mentioned it before, doesn't necessarily mean aliens. They're just unidentified. Marina, your thoughts on that, though, the connection there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the connection there, the caller mentioned, you know, sci-fi, Star Wars, you know, Bezos, Branson, and Musk, they were all heavily influenced by, you know, the moon landing, science fiction, and they, especially Musk, have these grand dreams of bringing humanity to Mars and making a home there. I'm curious to know what they think about these UFO reports, which, as you said, like, there's no indication right now to suggest anything of extraterrestrial origin. But I'm curious to know what they would think. But I think, you know, the way that their space ambitions are, like, we are going to be the aliens. Elon Musk wants to take people to Mars. In that case, we are very much the aliens.
Joe, thanks for the call. Tim joins us next now in Mount Horeb. Tim, hello.
Hi. I was going to say, I think this technology is a good idea. It's going to help jet propulsion. From the 60s, we know what we gained from all that technology. We're still living off it today. So I'm thinking it's a good thing, and it's only going to provide more renewable stuff in the future, aircraft and less fuel.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Marina, what do you think of that idea that this cutting edge stuff is going to have a good, as Tim says, a spillover effect?
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. I mean, it's hard to predict, like, right here, right now, how what kind of benefits, you know, to technology these types of flights might have. I mean, of course, Branson and Bezos are kind of repeating the feats of NASA from the 1960s. But still, you know, when people criticize them and say, oh, why are these space billionaires doing them? I often think about the engineers and technicians and scientists who work at Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin and SpaceX, for whom, you know, they're doing cutting edge stuff. So I do think there are advancements being made in these fields, and it's hard to predict what kind of spillover benefits there might be, but I'm not going to say there are going to be no spillover benefits. There very well might be.
Thanks a lot for that call. Marina, looking to the future now, Branson's been up, Bezos is getting ready to go. Beyond that, what are the next steps in you know, these orbital flights or near orbital flights and space tourism that you're watching for?
Right. So definitely next week will be a big one with Bezos, his turn, taking his trip to space. And then after that, I'm looking ahead to mid-September, and that's when four people are scheduled to fly on a SpaceX vehicle into orbit. So there's no doubt whether they're in space or not, and spend potentially a couple of days looping around the Earth. And what's fascinating about this mission is that there is not a single NASA astronaut on that crew. It's going to be, you know, the first all civilian private space flight. One of the passengers has a pilot experience, and he's actually a very wealthy tech entrepreneur, and he bought the entire ride and chose who else was going to come with him. So that's coming up in mid-September, classic launch from Cape Canaveral in Florida, and that should be pretty exciting because, you know, some of these vehicles are extremely autonomous now, which is scary to think about. And occasionally does maybe gives the false impression that any of this is safe. I think that's one takeaway that I hope your listeners have from this is that spaceflight, whether you're going to the edge of space or into orbit, is still very dangerous and it's not routine at all.
That said, Marina, I got to ask you, report on space, given the opportunity, would you want to report from space?
I mean, that would certainly be a heck of a dateline, wouldn't it? Like from orbit, I think... Oh my gosh, it would stress my family out so much, and I don't want to leave my cat behind, so I'd have to think about it.
Very fair. Well, I'm prone to motion sickness. I think I would probably be disqualified for that. Marina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for the conversation.
That's Marina Corin, staff writer covering space exploration at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about private companies, Virgin Galactic, Blue Origin, SpaceX, getting into space tourism and what that means for the future of space travel. A team of UW-Milwaukee researchers was behind a scientific first this year, the first observation of a black hole and a neutron star colliding and merging into each other. Using gravitational waves, they detected the event millions of light years away, and that could give us a new understanding of what exactly makes up neutron stars and how black holes interact with what's around them. Jolien Creighton is a professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. He researches gravitational waves and was part of the team that led this discovery. Jolien, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to first define a term here. I think people are familiar with the concept of the black hole. Neutron star may not be as much of a household word. What is that?
Well, a neutron star is a very, very dense object. It's more massive than our sun. But its size is probably around the same size as Madison. So about 10 miles across and mass of the sun. And it's probably the densest matter that exists anywhere in the universe.
And the key to this discovery, and a lot of interesting discoveries to come, I think, is gravitational waves. What are gravitational waves? How can we spot them?
Well, gravitational waves are actually ripples in space-time. So they are similar to electromagnetic waves, which are light and radio. But instead of electricity and magnetism, it's actually the gravity, which by general relativity, the theory of Einstein, is actually the space and time of the universe that is rippling. And as space and time ripples, that changes like the rate at which clocks tick and the distances between objects. And so we measure them by measuring very small distortions in distances between objects as the waves pass by us.
And I imagine it takes a lot of mass to make an observable gravitational wave, something like a massive neutron star in a black hole, which is what you observed. Like, we're not going to just find little stuff with gravitational waves, right?
No, we have to look for very, very massive objects, things that are more massive than our sun and very dense. So basically we can see neutron stars hitting neutron stars, black holes hitting black holes, and just now a neutron star hitting a black hole.
Now walk us through what you and your team did to suss out these gravitational waves and figure out this is our first observation of a neutron star whomping into a black hole.
Yes, well, as the neutron star and the black hole were orbiting each other, the amount of radiation they produce is so much that the orbit loses energy and gradually the system, the orbit will decay. This causes them to move faster and radiate even more until they finally smack into each other. And that gives us a signal that we receive that is a signal that is changing in frequency as the system is orbiting faster, and it swoops up in frequency And that's how we measure it. We measure the speed at which this thing is swooping up in frequency. And from that, we can deduce what the masses of the bodies were.
And as I understand it, I mean, I would picture, if I pictured it, Jillian, a black hole eating up this neutron star, or I don't know, a super explosion. It seems like this is more of a merger, if I'm reading this right.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it depends very much on exactly how much bigger the black hole is than the neutron star. So if the black hole is significantly bigger than a neutron star, then what will happen is the neutron star will just get swallowed whole by the black hole. But if they're more or less comparable sizes, then it's possible that the black hole will shred the neutron star up before it eats most of the material. And if that happens, that could be quite exciting because that would produce a lot of light and other radiation that we could see. And it might even eject a lot of the neutron star material into the galaxy that the system was lying in.
Now, with the gravitational waves that you observe, can that point us toward where in the universe this happened, or do we just know kind of that it happened and how far away?
We can actually determine the direction to the source to some degree. A gravitational wave detector is kind of more like your ears than your eyes. So you can hear something, but you might not know exactly where it came from. We use the fact that we have multiple detectors around the world to try and triangulate in the sky where the system might have come from. So like having microphones in various different places in the room, you might be able to figure out where the source of the sound is coming from a little bit better. But it's still a fairly large patch of sky that we had to locate it to.
Now, I know when I look at a star in the night sky, the light I'm seeing right now actually was emitted, depending on where the star is, hundreds or thousands or more years ago. Is it the same deal with gravitational waves?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. The gravitational waves also travel at the speed of light. And so these waves have been traveling to us for about a billion years.
Wow. Okay. Now, what you've made this discovery, I imagine you're not looking to stop there. What kind of things are you fishing for now in our gravitational wave detectors?
Well, we hope to see a whole lot more of these. And hopefully we will see some of these systems both in gravitational waves and in light. It turns out the two that we found, probably the neutron star got swallowed whole, but we're hoping to see perhaps some of the more violent ones where the neutron star gets ripped up. Those would be exciting to see. Gravitational waves are also looking, or the gravitational wave detectors are also looking for all sorts of other systems, things that we might not have seen so far. For example, they might be able to see nearby supernovae explosions or pulsars in our galaxy. These are things that we haven't detected yet, but hopefully we will be able to in the next few years.
Jillian, we'll leave it there. Good hunting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jillian Creighton is a professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. He was part of the team there that led the first observation of a collision between a neutron star and a black hole. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about gardening.
Across Wisconsin, there are people struggling to access healthy and culturally appropriate foods. It's a complex issue that some communities, like Green Bay, are addressing through community gardens. In 1994, a UW Extension nutritionist started the community garden program there with six families. This summer, more than 250 families are working 12 different plots in a partnership between the city of Green Bay and Brown County. A new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered is digging into those gardens and meeting some of the people who work there. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
Margaret Franchino has been working full time as the Brown County Community Garden Coordinator for the last 8 years.
I love being outside, and I think that was an important part of this. And then the multiculturalism of the gardens was really interesting to me, too, that people of all different backgrounds participate in the program. You know, I meet the most people out in the gardens, you know, just kind of organically being there and crossing paths with people. But it's just so interesting to hear, especially because so many of our gardeners are immigrants and are refugees, just hearing their stories and what gardening means to them and their gardening background. I mean, a vast majority of them are much better gardeners than I am, and so a lot to learn from them.
This is what mostly she grows. She grows the collard greens. Mm. This is, what is that? Sugar snappy leaves. Lemongrass. Lemongrass. Yeah, she plants a lot of lemongrass.
One of the people that will be working in the garden this year is Chow. She's been a community gardener for over 20 years. She's originally from Laos, a place where farming and gardening were a central part of her culture.
Back in Laos, we work in the because of the Hmong population, they all live in the mountain. So mostly you just use your hands and your shovel to work.
Chow started gardening as a kid in those mountains.
Since when I was little, as soon as I know how to dig, that's how I start my garden. And yes, I do remember back in the homeland.
And she still has the tools from back home.
Okay. Yes, we do. I do remember that. Because we still have some pictures back there. And also when I arrived to the United States, I actually had some of my own tools or some tools that belong to my parents. And yes, I still remember a lot of those memories.
Gardener Pedro Perez Perez lived in the area for 17 years. But before that, he was in California and Mexico, two very different growing climates than Wisconsin's. Pedro says his food home, the food that connects him back to those places, is salsa.
I would say tomatoes. Tomato salsa is one of the foods that I really identify with.
La salsa es en casi todas las comidas.
Salsa basically goes in every single food.
So Pedro needs his tomato plants to be hardy. And he's found Wisconsin's shorter growing season does have some benefits. Tomatoes grow better, but the seasons are shorter. So Pedro hustles to maximize the growing time.
Pues unos tres, cuatro días por semana.
I would say around 3 to 4 days per week.
A veces dos, tres horas por día.
Maybe 2 to 3 hours per day.
You're like a master gardener.
So, usted es un maestro en la jardinería.
No, pues es que si no trabaja uno, no cosecha.
If we don't work, obviously we will not be able to harvest our items.
Gardeners here rely on this land. It puts food in their kitchens and pantries throughout the year. But Margaret says the gardens also have another benefit. They build community.
So it really is a place for people to come together and meet people. Gardening is such a universal activity that people of all different backgrounds do. And so it's really special that they can come together and be together in that space. I don't think there's a lot of other spaces like that in the community. And so I think that's a really, really powerful thing.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
A new study is shedding light on why there are fewer native bumblebees in Midwestern states than there used to be. Part of the answer changes in the way we farm. Bumblebees are key pollinators for many crops and native plants. Our guest worked on this study and has some recommendations to help bring those bumblebee populations back up. Jeremy Hemberger is an ecologist and entomologist at the University of California, Davis. He got his PhD from UW-Madison. He specializes in how insects, especially bumblebees, respond to changes in the landscape because of agricultural practices and climate. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
How do bumblebee numbers today compare to what they were at the beginning of your study about 150 years ago?
It's a great question. Recently, we've seen a lot of a big decline in bumblebee numbers. Most notably, people have focused on like the rusty patch bumblebee, which has kind of captured people's hearts. And species like that are much rarer nowadays than they used to be. And this is true for a majority of the bumblebee species that we actually have here in the Midwest.
Why are native bumblebees important? Why are they a big deal for agriculture and the environment?
Sure. Yeah. So in Wisconsin, we have about 20 species of native bumblebees. It's not just one like we think of with the common European honeybee. And these are a really important ubiquitous pollinator. They visit a bunch of different crops like cranberries, blueberries, and apple. And they're also omnipresent in the landscape, just pollinating other plants that we care about, things like open tall grass prairies and such. And they're just a very charismatic species. They're something that we kind of identify with. We associate them with spring. They're these big, fluffy, furry things that fly around. I like to liken them to like these flying teddy bears. And they're just something that people seem to really identify with. And as such, we have a pretty good understanding of their numbers over time because people have collected them. They've identified them over those periods.
In this report I mentioned, Jeremy, you look at bumblebee numbers and how they correlate with how we farm, what choices we make in our crop production. What kind of things did you find out?
Sure. So, yeah, we were looking for, the study was really motivated by trying to figure out how changes in the landscape affect bumblebees. And as I started my PhD, I thought about this in a more contemporary sense, doing experiments, manipulating conditions in the landscape now. But we were always wondering how changes in agriculture over time really impacted these bees. And thanks to some data brought forth by a colleague of mine, Mike Crossley, who is a co-author on this study, we had this really cool data set that actually described changes in agricultural conditions from the U.S. Census of Agriculture from the 1850s all the way to present. So we had a really good idea of how the amount of cropland and the diversity of crops that we grow change over time. And what we found is that it's not just the amount of cropland that affects bees. We thought that as cropland increased, as colonizers took over the landscape and started to plant these large farms, we thought that would be really negatively associated with bumblebee numbers. But that actually wasn't necessarily the case. The amount of cropland in our landscapes in the Midwest actually peaked around 1900, and it's actually been pretty steady since then. And back then, we still saw that bumblebees were very likely to occur in the landscape. We saw a great diversity of species back then. And what really happened was in the 1940s and 50s, right after World War II, agriculture began to specialize, and it began to focus on growing a select few crops, primarily for agriculture and for feedlot production for animals. And with that, the decline in diversity of crops, we really saw a dramatic decline in bumblebee diversity. And that seems to be the most important lesson that we've learned from this, is that it's the loss of these diverse agricultural landscapes that grow multiple types of crops, have smaller farms. That seems to be what seems to be driving bumblebee numbers.
Talking to Jeremy Hemberger, ecologist and entomologist at the University of California, Davis. He got his PhD at UW-Madison looking at native bumblebee populations in Wisconsin and their connection to changes in the landscape, especially the farming landscape. Jeremy, does this point us toward answers to currently troubled native bumblebee species?
It certainly does. So I think one of the things that we took out of the study that really heartened us was that agriculture and bumblebees aren't necessarily at odds with one another. Certainly the way that we do agriculture now might be, but we can still have agriculture and bumblebee conservation that coexists in the same landscape. And there really seems to be opportunities to increase the number and diversity of bumblebees by rediversifying our agriculture to promote greater crop diversity. So moving from growing just corn, soy, and alfalfa to perhaps growing some other things, reintroducing pastures, wheat, small grains, stuff like that. And also using, associated with that, less chemical inputs, and increasing the diversity of other flowers. And these include non-crop plants, just like what we commonly call weeds in the landscape. So if we can help kind of bring back some of the elements of agriculture of yesteryear, that might have some beneficial impact on bumblebee populations as well.
That's something that people with large fields can do. Can someone with just, say, a small yard make a difference in their plant selections?
Definitely, yeah. I think collectively, a lot of folks, particularly in the Madison area, are really, really cognizant of bumblebee and bee conservation generally and already do this. But people can plant any sorts of native flowering plants in their yards, primarily those that will bloom all throughout the year. So bumblebees are this kind of unique bee that have a very long life cycle that starts in April and May and goes all the way into September and sometimes even October. So providing plants that are blooming throughout that entire period of time is really important, and also minimizing disturbances that we make in our gardens. So bumblebees are a native species that like things kind of messy. They nest in these underground cavities that are formerly occupied by rodents. They'll nest in kind of holes in rock walls and in tree holes. So they like things to be a little bit less clean than we typically like kind of a manicured lawn. And also minimizing the amount of pesticides, particularly insecticides, that we use in our gardens will also be really beneficial for them as well. So if folks can do those kind of three combination things, then that's a good thing for bumblebees.
And getting back to agriculture, are you hoping to see outreach efforts to farmers to encourage some of the crop diversity you're looking for here?
Definitely. And I don't want to try to put this too much on the heads of farmers. This is largely the changes that we've seen are not necessarily choices that farmers have made themselves. These are largely market forces that have pushed growers into these kind of production landscapes as we see them today. But there's certainly growers out there now that practice a little bit more diverse agriculture, particularly in areas like the Driftless region. There's some in Dane County and where Madison's located as well. But these are largely changes that we'd like to see come from the top, from farm bill policies and et cetera, that can help to kind of re-guide how we actually treat our landscapes with regard to agriculture.
What are some of the most nagging open questions you still have about native bumblebee populations here in the Midwest?
That's a great question. The truth is that with a lot of these species, we really don't know a whole lot about them. We know a lot about a select few species, things like rusty patch to an extent, and some of the more common species that we can see and we can rear in the laboratory and experiment with. But the majority of species we really know little about. So all these patterns that we found in our study are largely correlative. We don't have a causal link that necessarily says that agriculture changes bumblebees. It's that they're coordinated. They co-occur through time. So we'd really like to do some more experiments with some of these rarer, less abundant species to try to understand their biology, their ecology, and how they actually respond to these landscapes a little bit better. And with that, we'll be able to actually confirm these patterns that we've found in our study and help kind of guide the conservation of those species.
Just briefly, as we wrap up, Jeremy, do you have an experiment underway right now on one of those species?
Currently not, no. So I've kind of transitioned my work in California, and I'm actually working with how heat waves, which is a pretty relevant topic these days, affects bumblebees and their foraging and behavior and how that associates with crop pollination. But I'm actually moving back to the Midwest in August, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to continue working with some of these species there and kind of pick this work back up.
And we'll talk to you then, I'm sure. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That's Jeremy Hemberger, ecologist and entomologist who got his PhD from UW-Madison. He's now at the University of California, Davis, for now, it sounds like. We talked to him about his research on bumblebees, how lack of crop diversity may have helped drive their numbers down in the Midwest, and point toward a solution to bring them back in the future.